Thank you so much, Rabbi Zisuk, and thank you so much to everyone for joining us today in our virtual Gourmet Torah. I am very, very excited about what we're going to learn about this week. And I'll be honest, this was not a shiur that I prepared for lunch. This is a shiur that I prepared for this past Shabbos. This past Shabbos, the Skokie Yeshiva made its way to its namesake. We went to Skokie for Shabbos. We were in the Skokie community. We spent some davening in Chovaveh, with some davening in our Torah. We shared Divrei Torah. We had a lunch. It was beautiful. And the plan was that before lunch, I was going to share a few Divrei Torah with the parents that were in attendance. Those parents and scheduling didn't work out. And so I appreciate that you are all coming here today so that I can give this shiur that I had planned that I was so excited about. And with all that excitement in mind, I'm going to say something that might get me in trouble. These parshiyos are boring. We don't have stories about Avraham and Sarah. We don't have a Kadosh Baruch Hu hitting the Egyptians. We don't have the excitement of Kabbalah of Torah. This is building the Mishkan. I teach the ninth grade boys, as Rabbi Zisuk mentioned, and learning Chumash with them, learning the Rashis, it's not as exciting as the storylines that we're used to. And yet, I would suggest that these parshios, it's not my own suggestion, I've come to learn that these parshios have so much in them for us to pull out, and maybe it's not as explicit, but you got to go one step deeper. And we're not going to get into any real Kabbalistic sources, but what they say is that the Kabbalistic sources are much more prevalent in these parshios than they are in the storylines of Bereishis and the first half of Sefer Shmos. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look sort of at the surface level and see, surface level, okay, there might not be much going around, but if we look just beneath the surface, there's so much ripe for us to learn from, so much ripe material for us to gain. And so with that, we're talking about education. You know, I'm a Rebbe in the Skokie Yeshiva, and there's a challenge that exists in education. And this challenge doesn't just exist today. This is a challenge that existed 100 years ago, because we're going to begin with Rav Kolonimus Kalman Shapira, the Ish Kodesh, the Rav of the Warsaw Ghetto, a lover and embracer of growth of young children, of young Jews. And you know, they say that even though he was a Hasidic Rebbe, whenever there was a kid around, he would always make sure to put him on his lap, make sure that he felt good, even if it meant interrupting a shiur, even if it meant interrupting a chash of a meeting. He was the Rebbe of the children. And he writes his Kovas HaTalminim, his student's obligation. But in the Hakdama, in the introduction of that Sefer, he writes a call to Machanechem and to parents. He basically gives instructions of how to be a parent, how to raise a Jewish child. And then he proceeds to write a whole sefer to the Jewish child on how they're supposed to act. We actually learn it together with my shiur. And in that introduction, he says something beautiful, something so wonderful. The first time I heard it was from of Yeshiva HaKotel, from Rabbi Reuven Tarrigan. And so he says in this introduction, why is it that back in the day, education was effective, it worked. When we were growing up, we went to school, we learned, we did the things we were supposed to do, and yet today, doesn't work anymore. Talmidei kol malamed uvnei kol av rabam kulchem hayu ovdei Hashem. Everybody was an ovdei Hashem, v'lo kein ata, but that's not the case anymore. Hasib hapshuta v'hakaris hi. What's really the reason why education doesn't seem to be working the way that it used to? Shehanar kam v'choshev es atzmo l'ish b'terem b'malado. A person thinks, a kid thinks, you have a little 14-year-old ninth grader in the Skokie Yeshiva, and he thinks, ich bin a grown-up, I'm an adult, I don't need the advice of anyone else, I've got this all on my own. And he continues, and he says, jumping down a little bit, he says, kachi ha'uvda, this really is what happened, that there's a ruach shtus, there's a spirit of insanity that has overcome the youth of today. He thinks he's a full-fledged human adult. But really, his will, his inclinations, everything about him is unripe, it's bitter, he's not really quite there. And he couches this in the Gemara at the end of Masechta Sota that says that in the days of Mashiach, chutzpah is going to reign strong. Chutzpah is yaski. That the brazenness, that the chutzpah, that to think that you know more than your elders is going to get even stronger than it used to be. And so this is a tall order. This is challenging, that in a world of education in which seemingly the goal is for us to impart Torah messages, to us to impart our tradition, our Masorah, our values onto the next generation, the next generation isn't listening. The next generation is not interested in what we have to say. Now, if that was an issue 100 years ago, 1932, Akas Kamakama, so much more so, must be it be an issue today. And so just as a little bit of a sneak peek, my brother studied in Brandeis, and he studied under Dr. Jonathan Sarna. And in Sarna writes in 1994 that once upon a time, most people of this country adhered to faith and ethnicity in their parents. Their cultural identity was determined largely by their descent. Now, religious and ethnic loyalties are more commonly matters of choice. Identity, to a considerable degree, is based upon consent. Effectively, what Dr. Sarna is telling us, now we're talking 30 years ago, not 100, but even 30 years ago, so people don't care where they came from. People care about what's happening now. People care about, is this interesting to me? Do I want to engage? And we see that not just in the realms of just overall ideology. There's this concept of postmodernism. If anyone's familiar with postmodernism, then this is a very, very light, very, very brief overview. But effectively, it's the concept that really everything's relative, that there's like a suspicion of reason, of what has always been should not necessarily always be. And postmodernism, which is this philosophical trend that has kind of taken over the world over this past couple decades, effectively suggests that who cares that there's a Masorah that's 2,000 years old? 3,000 years old, sorry. Who cares that this is what my parents and my grandparents did? Who cares that I'm a link in the chain, as Rabbi Sachs Zatzal used to write? All of that doesn't make a difference. I'm going to chart my own path. And this spirit of independence that in some ways is nice is potentially going to undermine all possibilities of chinuch in the world today. And that doesn't just exist in Jewish education. In secular education, we see numerous instances in which the idea of someone knowledgeable as an adult, of someone, you know, a higher level in the Masorah, able to pass something down to the next generation, is also sort of out of vogue. You know, even the 1966, I remember studying this when I was in grad school for education. You had A.S. Neal, who started the free school. And effectively, his whole approach was, to quote, "The purpose of an education was not to control the child or to inculcate a set of values or beliefs, but to find out where a child's interest lies and help him live it out." Education was not to communicate Torah values. Education was just kind of to follow the kid's path. We see this even today in Montessori schools, Montessori's principles, which really are about following the kid and not by imparting anything external. And while in some ways, you know, it sounds nice to follow the kid where they need to be, we have a concept of a Masorah. We have Matan Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu received the Torah and informed the Jewish people. He didn't say, "Jewish people, what do you think?" Moshe said, "A Kodesh Baruch Hu gave us a gift. We need to learn it." And that's what I spend every day here doing. And the struggle that we're going to try and figure out, we're going to take three paths, three solutions, if you will, to answer it, is in a generation, in a century, when so many people are not interested in something just because someone older said it, someone experienced, someone wiser said it, how are we supposed to communicate Torah to somebody? How are we supposed to teach Torah? And I think the Mishkan has the answer to that question. So we're going to look at three things, the first of which is going to be the largest and the most exciting. And I'll just preface it by telling you that this is a very good Dvar Torah. And not only is it a good Dvar Torah because it's striking and it penetrates, but it's also a very good Dvar Torah because this is a Dvar Torah that you can say both for Parshas Truma and for Parshas Vayakel. And so I've got you covered. In 2 weeks' time, you will have a Dvar Torah to share at your Shabbos table or just at a Stam lunch during the week. You're allowed to learn Torah during the week like we do here. And so in last week's Parsha, in Perachaf Hei, it talks about the various kelim, the various vessels in the Beis HaMikdash. Sorry, the Mishkan, applies to Beis HaMikdash as well. And it points out that a few of them, two in particular, are made miksha. Now, miksha is often translated as it's hammered out. Effectively, when they're building the shulchan, when they're building the table, they would melt down various pieces of gold and then connect them, put them together. Except a few of the kelim were not supposed to be made piecemeal, but they were supposed to take one block of metal and hammer out the keli, the vessel, from that block of metal. Those two examples are the menorah and the kruvim, the cover of the Aron Kodesh. Now, it's interesting to note that the shulchan, not so complicated to make. It was a table with, like, you know, some beams. The mizbeach, the altar, pretty easy to make. The menorah, intricate kafter afarach. There was so much intricacy in it, and that had to be made of one unified piece. Very interesting. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a beautiful approach to explain it, but not for now. Similarly, the Kruvim were also intricate and complicated, and why those specifically needed to be mikshah, we can see Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. But for us, the menorah and the aron both need to be made mikshah. There's one other vessel, if you will, of the Beis Hamikdash, of the Mishkan, but it's not really of the Mishkan, but one other vessel of that time frame that was made mikshah. Anyone know what it is? All right, we're muted. I'll jump in. We don't see it in Truma. We don't see it in Vayakha. We don't see it at the end of Sefer Shmos. Instead, we see it in Sefer Bamidbar, in Parshas Baaloska. Moshe Rabbeinu was instructed by a Kaddish Baruch Hu, Vadibar Hashem al Moshe Leimor. This is Perek Yud, Psukim Aleph and Beis. Aseh lecha shtei chatzotzros kesef. Miksha ta'aseh osam v'hayu lecha l'mikra ha'eda ulamasa esamachanos. Moshe Rabbeinu is instructed to make trumpets. And those trumpets are supposed to be made of silver, not of gold, fine. But they're also supposed to be made hammered work. They're supposed to be miksha, carved out. And so we have three kelim in the Mishkan, effectively in the Mishkan, that are supposed to be made miksha. And Dr. J.J. Schachter, a scholar at Yeshiva University, rabbi's rabbi, who I've been zocher to learn a lot of Torah from him. I was in his class in Jewish autobiography. I think I learned more Torah than I did history in that class. He has such a beautiful approach, and I think about this every single year at this time of year. The Kruvim really represent the Aron, and so the Aron is Aron representing Torah. Torah is supposed to be miksha. Torah is supposed to be made of one singular piece. And so too, the chatzosros, the trumpets, are supposed to be made of one singular piece. Except there's a huge difference between the Torah, between the Aron, and the chatzosros, the trumpets. The chatzotzros, the Gemara Menachos tells us, can never be used again. The chatzotzros can be used by Moshe Rabbeinu and only Moshe Rabbeinu. Menachos on Pehei Amid Beis tells us, Kol HaKelim She'asa Moshe, K'sherim Lo, K'sherim L'doros. Moshe made various kelim in the Beis HaMikdash, and the Mishkan, I keep saying that, sorry. And they can be used by him, and they can be used in future generations. Except, chatzotzros, K'sheros Lo, Moshe's chatzotzros, his trumpets were good for him. However, Psulos Lidoros. They were puzzle for future generations. Now, why is that? Because on the total opposite, the Aron, not only could you not remake it, was it not kosher for the next generation, but we made one Aron, Moshe made an Aron, and that's the only Aron we ever used. You know, there's a whole discussion in the Gemara and the Achronim and the Rishonim about, you know, was there a second Aron that they used for battles? But effectively, there's one Aron, and in the first Beis Hamikdash, they had an Aron Kodesh. In the second Beis Hamikdash, they did not have an Aron HaBris. The Aron HaBris was gone because they hid it after the destruction of the first, and it never came back. And so you have this Keli, the Beis Hamikdash, the Aron HaBris that was constant forever, was never changing, was never going to be remade, and the Chatzosros, which changed every single generation. And says Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter that the Aron represents Torah, and Torah does not change. However, the Chatzotros, the call to Torah, that must change. Not only is it allowed to change, it has to change. The call to Torah, what's going to bring people in to learn and engage in Torah in the days of Moshe, will not be the same in the days of Yoshua. It will not be the same in the days of the Shoftim. The call to Torah must change each and every generation. My good friend, Rabbi David Beshefkin, is an expert educator, and he speaks frequently. He speaks in NCSY, he's a doctor of economics, and speaks frequently in shuls. And I've asked him once, you know, how do your different Torah change for a teenager versus you know, a highly educated adult? And he says, to be honest, the Torah is the same. The Torah stays the same. Just his introduction, his hook, you know, the way that he gets people engaged, only that's going to change. You know, if he's talking to a teenager, you know, he might reference sports, he might reference, you know, superheroes. And if he's talking to highly educated adults, he might use some of his economic background to bring them in. But ultimately, the Torah is always going to stay the same. He might use different chatzotzros, but the Torah that he communicates will never change. And that is going to be our first takeaway. That's going to be our first lesson, that the chatzotzros, the call to Torah might look different in every generation, but never ever think for one moment, God forbid, that the Torah that we're communicating to the next generation is not just as applicable today as it was in the past. That Torah is never changing. And Rav Hirsch takes it one step further. Rav Hirsch points out that the badim, the poles in the Aron, were never removed. if we had the menorah, then remember the Mishkan is a mobile edifice, and so the menorah, they would put in poles, put it on their shoulders, carry it to the next location, put down the menorah, pull out the poles, and put them in storage. And the Shulchan, they would put in the poles, put, host it on their shoulders, walk on the way, arrive at their destination, put down the Shulchan, pull out the poles, and put the poles in storage. The Aron HaKodesh, they would bring it to the next location, but when they put down the Aron, they did not remove the poles. As a discussion in Sekhas Yuma, if there were actually two sets of poles, there were traveling poles and not traveling poles, but the takeaway, the important thing, is that you can never remove the poles. Lo yasur mimenu v'hamaser bade Aron loka, and you'll get Malkos, says the Gemara in Sekhas Yuma, and daf ayin beis amud aleph, if you remove the poles from the Aron. Why, says Rav Hirsch? Not only is it that Torah is never changing, but there are always poles in the Aron. The poles indicate that the Aron is always ready to move. The Aron is ready to move here. The Aron is ready to move there. Aron is ready to move from one generation to the next generation, from one location to the next. There is no part of life, there is no generation in the world that will ever, where Torah will not be applicable. Torah is constant. The term that David Beshefkin likes to use is that Torah is omnirelevant. It will always be relevant. It will always have lessons for us to learn. And no matter what age, no matter what generation, no matter what time, what circumstance, Torah will always have something to share. The first approach of how to impart something on our students who may or may not be interested in learning, who might think that they know better, is to impress upon them that Torah is never changing. But the call to Torah might change. They might not be interested because they think, oh, it's the same old Torah. No, that Torah can change. That the Torah doesn't change, but that Torah will move. The Torah will be applicable no matter what. But the call to Torah, what's going to bring them into that Torah learning, might not be the same this generation as it was last generation. As a matter of fact, it probably won't. And that's our first approach. Our second approach is found in the Gemara Maseches Baba Metzia on Daf Pei Hei Amud Beis. And it's a conversation between Rabbi Hanina and Rabbi Chiya. And it almost seems like they're having like a competition. There's a little bit of like a rabbinic smack talk, if you will, if we could say such things. And they're going back and forth. And Rabbi Hanina would tell Rabbi Chiya, you can't really debate with me. You can't disagree with me. I'm so brilliant that if we forgot all of our Torah, I could recreate with Pilpul, with the back and forth, with my ingenious thought process, I could recreate the entirety of the Torah just through my own powers of analysis. And Rabbi Chiya says back to Rabbi Hanina, you think you could debate me? I'm the one who's going to make sure that Torah is never forgotten. You might be able to rebuild Torah. Because of me, Torah will never be lost. And let me explain to you why. Because my Avidna, Azlina v'shadina kisna v'kedlila nishve v'asadne netave u'ma'achin v'asrayhu litme. He says, I'm going to collect flax seeds, and I'm going to turn them into twine, make nets with them. I'm going to hunt down deer and feed the meat to orphans. And then I'm going to prepare parchment. And I'm going to use the parchment from that deer, and I'm going to write the five books of Moses, Chamisha Chumshe Torah. Veslikna Lamasa, and I'm going to go to a city, Umakrina Chamishin Yanuke, and I'm going to call five separate young individuals, and I'm going to give one of those books to each one of the individuals. And then I'm going to teach six other individuals, well, these Shisha Sedra Mishnah, one book per kid. So now there are 11 kids who have been imparted with one Sefer, whether of Chumash or of Mishnah. And then he tells them, teach each other. I'm going to be back, but I'm not going to teach you. You're going to teach you. In the world of education, we call this a jigsaw classroom, where people learn certain things and then share that information with each other. But effectively, what Rabbi Chiya is saying is that the reason why Torah will never be forgotten is because I don't teach them Torah. They teach them Torah. And what that means is that they own it. My colleague in NCSY, Rabbi Shmuley Green, used to say all the time, and it took me so long to understand it, that you have to own your Torah. You have to own your Jewish engagement. If you don't own it, if someone's doing it for you, you're not going to engage. And so the goal for me has always been, since I learned this, that students should be teaching. Yes, can I teach them Torah? Do I know more Torah than they do? For sure. But I would much rather spend time helping them teach Torah, because if they teach Torah, Torah will stick with them. This doesn't just exist in education. It exists in organizational world as well. If I want someone to be engaged, if I want someone to take part in my organization, want them to like my organization, then I'm not going to teach them. I'm not going to talk to them. I'm not going to tell them what they need. Instead, I'm going to ask them, you know, what can you do? How can you contribute and make them care about the problem? You know, if I'm, God forbid, running a home for sick children, running a hospital, and I need the medication. Yeah, I could send for the medication. Amazon will drop it off in 2 days, which is really going to be like 9.5 days. They're going to overcharge me for it. But I could get the medication on my own. But if I want you to care about this cause as well, I'm going to ask you to get the medication. And you're going to see how much medication these young children need. And then you're going to say, I have to do something about this. Once you engage, then you're going to care. And the second way that we'll impart Torah on the next generation is by engaging them, by telling them that the Torah will not continue if not for you. Those 11 children, says Rabbi Chiya, will prevent the Torah from ever being forgotten. And that's our second lesson, that if you give people a reason to care, if you give people an ownership of the Torah, they won't fail you, they're not going to lose the Torah either. Our final approach is based on this week's parasha, based on Parsha Tetzaveh, because we learned about the tzitz. And the tzitz, you know, that golden plate that sat on the forehead of the Kohen Gadol, the tzitz would create a ritzoi. It would atone for Tumas Mikdash, amongst other things. And as the tzitz didn't do anything. It sat on Aaron's forehead, sat on the Kohen Gadol's forehead, but if it was on the Kohen Gadol's forehead, then Jewish people would be forgiven for their sins. They'd be forgiven for arriving at the Mikdash impure. And you have to wonder, like, why? Just because he's wearing something, that should achieve kapara? You want to tell me you bring a karban? Okay, I can appreciate that. You want to say you daven a lot? I can get that. But he's just wearing a golden plate. Why is just a golden plate going to achieve kapara for the Jewish people? Now, admittedly, the golden plate did say Kodesh LaHashem, and some people will say, some of Farshim, the Chasam Sofer in particular, says that it's about the direction that you're focusing on. It's about... When people look at the Kohen Gadol, they see Kodesh LaHashem, about, you know, your heart and your mind, it's all focused on a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that's why people are going to be forgiven. But maybe we could say it a little differently. Because there's a Gemara in Maseches Moed Katan, Daf Yomi saw it a couple weeks ago, about quoting the Pasuk in Mishlei. And the Pasuk in Mishlei says, Ki sifse Kohen Yishmeru Das, V'Tor Yivachru Mipiyu, Ki Malach Hashem Tzvakosu. Sorry, it's not Mishlei, it's in Malachi, my apologies. And Malachi, it says that, you know, for a Kohen's lips is going to be the keeper of knowledge, and they should seek Torah from that Kohen's mouth, because he is a messenger, he's a Malach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Gemara in Moed Katan, they play with it, and they say, no, when we say Malach Hashem Tzvakosu, we don't literally mean that he's a messenger for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we mean that he's a Malach, that he's an angel. And the Gemara continues and says, Im Doma HaRav LaMalach Hashem, if your rabbi is like an angel, Yivakshu Torah Mipiv, then you should request Torah from him. V'im lav, al yivakshu Torah Mipiv. If not, don't ask for Torah. When the Kohen Gadol is walking around in the Big Day Kahuna, when the Kohen Gadol is walking around with the tzitz, the Kodesh LaHashem on his forearm, or LaHashem Kodesh, depending on the Machlokas in Maseches Yoma, the Kohen Gadol is representing, he looks like a Malach, he's acting like a Malach. When the Kohen Gadol is that Rebbe, then you're able to request Torah from him. When the Kohen Gadol is embodying everything we want to see in a Jew, he's setting that example. People will learn from him. Am Yisrael will get a kapara, they'll get a mechila for their sins, because they're going to know better because of it. Aaron HaKohen is that same individual who would do kir, says the Tana Devei Eliyahu, Pirkei Rabbi Elazar. The Pirkei Rabbi Elazar tells us that Aaron HaKohen was that individual who would do kiruv. Oy shalom v'rode shalom, oy v'sabrios u'mekarvim l'Torah. How did he bring them close to Torah? Just by being Aaron. By going up to the guy and saying, hey, how's it going? You're the man. You're great. And they would think, Aaron's so holy. If he thinks I'm holy, I must be something more than I am. How can I possibly sin if Aaron thinks I'm so good? So when the Kohen Gadol is doing what he's supposed to do, when the Kohen Gadol is epitomizing and embodying the ideals that we set as a Jew, other people learn from that. But it's not just the Kohen Gadol. Because so often in education, whether it's at home, whether it's at work, whether it's at school, people learn from what you do, not from what you say. People learn from the personality that you are. You know, the same education, 20, 30 years from now, your students will not remember what you taught them, but they will remember how you made them feel. The personality of the Torah teacher, of that Baal HaMasorah, is in some ways so much more important than the intricate details that they provide. And so when we look to the Mishkan and we look for some clue of chinuch, our third avenue is going to be to not worry about education. Don't educate. Don't tell them anything. I remember being in an NCSY meeting very, very early on, and one of my older colleagues said, I was giving a specific example. He said, you think that you should talk right now? And he's telling you, that's your heart. Which was an anathema to hear for the first time. But he was 100% right. Rabbi Ariel Bannett, he really understood how these things work. And sometimes the goal is to not teach Torah. Sometimes the goal is to just be the best representation of Torah possible. And when you're that representation of Torah, they'll learn on their own. They don't need you to tell them. They'll get it just by themselves. And so we saw three chinuch lessons from the Mishkan today. One of my favorites is that Torah is constant, Torah is ever-changing. Torah is always going to transfer from one place to another, like the Rav Hirsch points out. But the call to Torah, that can't stay the same. That needs to change. And so they're both made miksha. They're both made in such a way that they're hammered out from one solid piece. But whereas the Torah is never changing, the call to Torah must always change. We must always figure out, what does this generation need to hear? How are they going to engage in that constant, that beautiful, that unchanging Torah? That's approach number one. Approach number two, we said that through the Rabbi Chiya and the Gemara Maseches Bava Metzia, Pehei and Beis, that if you want people to care about Torah, you have to give people a reason to care, give them ownership of the Torah, and then they'll engage. And finally, if we focus less on the Talmidim, less on the receivers, and more on the givers, if we make ourselves better, then we'll set that example that they'll want to follow. And so with those three examples, I just want to conclude with something from Rav Shlomo Volbi. Rav Volbi says in his Alei Shor that, you know, you might meet a kid, and you see that they're drinking soup. And you say, you know, why are you having that soup? And they'll tell you, well, my mother had that soup, and my grandmother had that soup, and so I'm going to have that soup. And Rav Volbi says, what? What are you talking about? That's not a reason to have soup. Why does somebody eat soup? Because it's delicious. You have soup because it tastes good. And so on the one hand, we want to communicate a Masorah. We want to pass down a Masorah from generation to generation. And we are those individuals who are going to pass it down to our children, to our grandchildren, to our students. But ultimately, we want our students to find the beauty in that Torah. They want them to enjoy the taste, the flavor of that soup. And so if we can leave you with just that one message at the end, we had our three approaches, but ultimately, all three of those approaches that are focused on me shouldn't make a difference. The focus really should just be on making sure that our children appreciate the beauty and deliciousness of the soup that is Torah. Thank you so much for learning with me, and have a wonderful, wonderful Shabbos.
My Zucker, thank you so very much. You should call out.